The average American continues to get richer and live longer. But if you're male and don't have a college degree, are things actually getting worse? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. A rising tide lifts all boats, or does it? Recent evidence has highlighted the declining fortunes of one group in particular in the United States. A new paper called The Lost Ones compares the outcomes for Americans who didn't go to college born in the 1960s with the fortunes of the previous generation. And Maria Cristina Di Nardi of the Minneapolis Fed, she's also a CEPR fellow, is one of its authors. She joins us today to tell us what they discovered. Maria Cristina, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello, Tim.
We're becoming much more aware of how aggregate growth hasn't translated into equally good outcomes for everyone. And this group in particular has caught the attention of researchers. What was the gap in our knowledge that you wanted to fill with this paper?
Well, there is a lot of research in economics, in growth, on business cycle, that is how the economy fluctuates across recessions and expansions, on inequality and on the effects of various policies that you can use to try to improve on the outcomes that would naturally occur. But there is a big gap in terms of studying the opportunities and the outcomes of different cohorts of people over their entire life cycle. These changes affect people during all of their lives, so it's not some kind of temporary shock, and so they can have very large effects. For instance, you can be affected by the kind of economic conditions when you enter the labor market. If you enter during a recession or in a really bad economic time, it can affect your labor market outcomes over all of your life. Similarly, the kind of technological progress that takes place when you are on the labor market is very important in affecting the opportunities and your success. We consider three important changes for the less educated, as you said, born in the 1940s and 1960s. Changes in wages, changes in out-of-pocket medical expenses, changes in life expectancy, and then we also evaluated the consequences of these changes. Previous work had analyzed some of these changes in a disconnected way and more from the point of view how are things changing over time rather than how are things changing for a cohort of people that are born in different years. And this is the gap that we are filling.
You compared these two cohorts, as you said, they're only 20 years apart, and that's not long. So what changes can happen in that time to society and the labour market that you could suspect might cause very different outcomes for this group?
20 years does sound like a short time, but if you think of the amazing technological progress that we have been making over 20 years to the way that we produce things, to the internet, the way we communicate, you can see that there is an enormous amount of technical change. In particular, there has been a lot of technical change that is skill biased. It really improves the productivity of those that are most educated. So, in my opinion, it's really skill biased technological change that has had a big effect. So, let me provide you with an example. Literacy. Right? There used to be a period in history when the literate people were the elite. They were those that were doing best in society, and they were a very small privileged group. And then over time, the median person was literate. And now in developed societies, literacy is really an absolute necessity to be able to work, to communicate, to function in society. So the skill bias technological change we have had is basically made it so that college education is like the new literacy. Basically, if you're not college educated, your opportunities have worsened considerably.
If we compare the opportunities for these two cohorts, men born in the 1960s had much more opportunity to go to college. So surely if you're comparing the cohorts of non-college males, the younger cohort is going to be much more made up of the less talented or the less hardworking. And so we're not comparing like with like.
Yes, you're completely right, and we were very worried about that too. Across these two particular cohorts, the completion of four-year colleges went up about 6%. In addition, there is another form of selection you need to worry about within the group that we consider. We do know that people who dropped out from high school decreased a lot, while the fraction of people that had at least some college increased. So in our work, we analyze extensively this amount of selections. One is selection out of the sample, because some people graduate, and the other is the selection of the people in the group that you consider. And we find very similar changes in wages, in life expectancy, and medical expenses. So it's not that we have, as you said, people who work less hard or have a harder time getting an education that remain in our sample, but it's something deeper that we think has to do with the kind of technology and the way labor markets are evolving.
Your first estimate in this paper is of how much these two groups earn. Have the earnings of non-college males just grown more slowly than other groups, or are they actually earning less?
Absolutely, Tim. This is very important. We all know that inequality has been increasing. So you could have, as you said in the beginning, a rising tide that lifts all of the boats, but bigger boats by more. This is not what happened. Actually, the wages of the less educated went down in real terms. And we have been worrying about how you measure these real wages, because you need to take a stand on inflation. To the extent that you think the prices of goods and services rise, that is very important to determine whether real wages have fallen or not. We have been recently investigating this more and using the best price indexes for this type of people rather than those generic price indexes like the CPI that are commonly used. And we have convinced ourselves that this is a really solid fact. It's not only a relative change, but it's really an absolute drop in the wages.
Now, this group also has a higher cost of medical care later in life. How much higher are we talking about?
Well, we need to make a forecast for this, because those born in the 60s are currently entering retirement, and obviously retirement is the period when medical expenses are largest, and that's the period we focus on. We have done extensive analysis using previous cohorts and trends over time, and our best forecasts are that their out-of-pocket medical expenses, so meaning what they will pay after the government and the private insurance pays, will go up by 80% during the retirement period. So that's a really large change, as you said, over a 20-year period.
Were you able to confirm the research that we've seen in the last few years that non-college educated people in the US are dying younger as well?
Unfortunately, yes. Case and Deaton had a very influential work documenting increased mortality for white and less educated people. Their analysis looked at people age 50 to 59 over time, and by education and race. We went a step further and we said, let's take as given the data that we do observe, and let's use, as we did for medical expenditures, previous cohorts and time trends to forecast what the whole life expectancy is going to be for this cohort. Meaning, if I tell you that mortality at age 50 went up 22%, it sounds like a large number, but what does it really mean? What we find is that mortality at age 50 and at age 66 both went down by 1 to 2 years, depending on your gender and marital status. So then, you know, it's much easier to grasp your mind around to thinking, well, 1 or 2 years just at age 50 is a large change in life expectancy. So not only we confirmed this finding, but we put it in context of what a person at retirement time is expecting in terms of how long they have to save and how long they will be around more generally.
The model you use looks at individual outcomes, but you've also taken care to look at the outcomes for couples as well. So why did you do that?
Yeah, if we think this is a very interesting and very important way to look at things, it's technically challenging, and that's why not many people have done it before. But there are several reasons why I think it's very important to do this. First of all, the wages of the men born in the 1960s, white and without a college education, went down about 9% compared to those born in the 1940s. If you look at women, they actually increased a little bit. They increased by 7%. The interesting finding is that they did increase because women, first of all, had more education. Even within the group that we consider, there were fewer high school dropouts and more women with some college. But especially, they had much more labor market experience. They participated in the labor market in much higher numbers and they worked many more hours. And this labor market experience is really an important driver of wages. We think it would be misleading to consider in isolation men and women. Many people are in couples. And if you have the wages of the man going down a lot, but the wages of the woman holding steady or maybe going up because of her increased experience, you can get completely different results. We think that it's really important to think about couples and singles and how being in a couple with someone who had different labor market outcomes from yours can affect the findings. In fact, we find that single men lost much more than people in couples in welfare terms, exactly because there was the potential wage of the other couple members and the other person was working much more to decrease the negative wealth effect that was driven by these decreasing wages for men.
This labor market attachment effect that we are seeing for women means that men in this category have done much worse than women in this time.
Yes, certainly if you think about wages, women didn't lose as much in terms of earnings, but they did have to work much more. So if you think that leisure is an important component of welfare, they lost a lot of welfare by working much more. And, you know, there is also something we don't analyze. These women were working a lot in the house before, not like they were idle, and now they are working on the marketplace. So I think it's interesting to think about all of these components together. And in future work, it would also be interesting to consider shifting production from the home to the marketplace, which is not something that we have done so far.
You found a way to express the total welfare loss between these two cohorts. How did you do that?
Yes, first of all, we extensively documented these changes in a coherent data set that represents this group of people very well. And then we took a model of how people behave and choose to work and to save in the face of these changes. And we used this model to match the data so that we have confidence that we have a good laboratory economy that is going to be able to give you some useful answers. The bottom line from using data and model together is that single men, because their wages dropped and they had lower human capital and they didn't have a spouse, at least at the beginning at age 25, they lost much more than anyone else. To give you an idea about the size of the loss, if you ask how much should I give a 25-year-old average single man in the 1960s court in terms of assets to make him indifferent between the 1940s and the 1960s wages, medical expenses, and life expectancy, well, that amount of assets is equivalent to almost 13% of the present discounted value of their lifetime income. Put it in context of the costs from business cycle fluctuations or other costs, this is a huge amount. You would have to compensate them for 13% of their lifetime labor income to have them indifferent between the three changes in the 40s and the 60s that we consider. When you look at people in couples, because you have a wife who can also participate and whose wages are higher because of labor market and participation, the drop in welfare is 8%, which is much lower than 13%, but is not negligible because the wife had to work much harder outside of the house, and therefore these changes didn't happen at no cost. If you look at single women, they lost a little less, 7%. Part of the reason why this number is still so high is that they still expect to get married at some point and to meet a man with much lower wages and to have to work much harder because they know that their wealth as a couple is going to be much lower unless they work more.
I note that you're doing this from within the Opportunity and Inclusive Growth Institute at the Minneapolis Fed. And it makes me think that conditions for opportunity and inclusive growth in the US are very different to what they are in Europe. So with the US's particular health insurance model and the fact that non-college educated workers immediately after the Second World War did particularly well in the US, does that mean that these results apply only to the United States, or can we generalize them across all the developed world?
I think this is a very interesting question, and it's dangerous to speculate without really looking at the data first. This being said, let me give you some sense of what I'm thinking. I expect that less educated people in other developed countries also lost in terms of real wages, because skill bias, technical change is a factor that affects all developed societies. The jobs that are really being rewarded are the jobs of people with high human capital. So my expectation would be that finding about the wages for lower educated people hold across several countries. In terms of medical expenses in the aggregate, those that the government pay and the individuals pay, are becoming more and more expensive. People are living longer, we treat more medical conditions, and we have increased the amount of time of some conditions that have become very expensive. So I do think that to some extent there will be a pressure for governments to shift more of the burden of paying medical expenses from general revenue to the individual themselves to try to reduce this cost. For instance, in the Netherlands, long-term care, basically nursing home costs, used to be paid completely by the government, and now they aren't. It's becoming really expensive to tax to provide all of these goods and services. So my expectation is that to some extent, in other countries, out-of-pocket medical expenditures can go up. You know, the other thing that can happen is that you make it harder for people to get good medical care. You have waiting lists, which is another way to affect the welfare of people, but it's harder to measure. In terms of life expectancy, that's where I'm less sure. We know about the opioid epidemic in the US, but I think your question points to the issue that it's very important to think about these changes across courts, across groups, and across countries to understand to what extent governments and institutions have an effect on these changes.
Well, we like on Vox Talks from time to time to make our guests policymaker for a day to suggest feasible policies that might fix the problems that they identify. But I wonder if there is a possible policy fix for this at the moment, Maria Cristina. Can you think of one?
Well, let's think of the programs that can have an effect when you have these kind of changes that are prolonged, they last all of your life cycle, and that they affect different groups. So you essentially have old age social security payments. To some extent, these programs prop up the incomes in retirement of the people who had worst labor market outcomes. Then you have progressive taxation, the taxes income at higher rates for the most successful. And then you have traditional transfer welfare programs for the poor. So in principle, all three of these instruments can help. But to give you a more precise answer, I think that what one needs to do is to look at these courts that we observe, at least for part of the life cycle, and evaluate more precisely in a quantitative way to what extent social security, progressive taxation, and social welfare have reduced or mitigated these changes. I think it's really hard to say we should make taxation more progressive, or we should give more transfers, or we should ensure a better social security floor without really making sure you know what you're talking about. And another thing that is necessary for policy is to decide how early should we intervene? When do we figure out that the court is going to have much worse labor markets all of their lives, right? If you are trying to affect them at age 50, it's too late. So not only you need to think about the kind of policies, but you also need to think when you should implement these policies in the life cycle of a court.
Maria Cristina, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim. I really appreciate it.
As Maria Cristina says, it's very important to know what you're talking about, and this is a major contribution to this in what has quickly become one of the most interesting strands of research into growth. The paper's called The Lost Ones, The Opportunities and Outcomes of Non-College Educated Americans Born in the 1960s, and the authors are Maria Cristina Di Nardi, Margarita Borella, and Fang Yang, and on the CEPR website, it is discussion paper 13582. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most interesting early stage research every week. If you don't want to miss an episode, then subscribe on your podcast platform, and you'll also get every episode from the past year if you do that. And if you want to go further back in time, there's an archive at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.